Iredell with Municipal Sustainable Energy Forum, and today our discussion is about energy policy updates in different parts of the country. We're going to start out with Andy McDowell at Apogee from Kentucky. Andy, why don't you go ahead?
Hi. Yes, I live in Frankfort, Kentucky, and have been active working with clean energy policy for the past 17 years or so in Kentucky. And I'm the director of the program Apogee Climate and Energy Transitions, which is a program of Earth Tools, a small business in central Kentucky. And I've worked with, I work with a lot of the advocacy organizations around the state who try to promote clean energy. And in terms of updating where Kentucky is at, Kentucky is quite far behind many other states in terms of clean energy policy. One of the best policies we've had in the recent 15 years has been our net metering law. But last year, the legislature directed the Public Service Commission to enact changes to the net metering law to enable utilities to recover their costs associated with providing net metering. And that will be adjudicated through the Public Service Commission in rate cases that the utilities are expected to bring starting sometime this year. And many of us worked very hard to prevent this legislation, and we actually stopped the utilities 2 years running, but last year we failed and the bill passed. So that was a significant setback and especially frustrating because in the big picture, net metering is fairly modest. It's one of the building blocks for energy policy, but it doesn't get you nearly as far as we need to go. Starting about maybe 12 years ago, we had drafted a renewable energy efficiency portfolio standard, and we'd gotten sponsors for that bill, but had never been able to get beyond a committee hearing. So we do not have a renewable portfolio standard in Kentucky, and the state energy policy has been really dominated by the coal economy and coal culture. And even as coal has waned in terms of its real economic value in the state, it holds a heavy cultural sway over the legislature. That is beginning to weaken. The electric utilities, meanwhile, also have a very strong influence over the legislature. And in Kentucky, we have a lot of utilities. There are maybe about 20 rural electric co-ops, which are regulated by the Public Service Commission. There are several investor-owned utilities. And then there is the TVA serves a large portion of southern and western Kentucky. And then there are maybe a couple dozen municipal utilities, which are not regulated by the Public Service Commission. And those range from, say, Owensboro Municipal Utility, which has probably 100,000 or more customers, to some small towns that have only a few hundred customers. About 5 years ago, the municipal utilities formed a new agency called the Kentucky Municipal Energy Agency, or KOMEA, which is intended to serve municipal utilities who join it and become members. And I have been especially involved regarding the KOMEA because the town that I live in, Frankfort, which is the state capital, was one of the founding members and is the second largest member of this new agency. But unfortunately, this agency started off by forming almost all of its portfolio from coal and natural gas. And there are a lot of very unfavorable elements of the contracts the municipals have signed with this agency. So I've put a lot of time and effort into trying to reform the agency and make it both a better agency for customers and also orient it more towards clean energy. And there are some positive signs in the state. While we have a Republican legislature, which is not supportive at all of renewables or efficiency, we have a new Democratic governor, and he appointed a secretary of the Energy and Environment Cabinet, which is responsible for the governor's energy policy, a person who has no ties to the utility industry or coal industry, which is quite a change, and has worked as an attorney who's worked as a consumer advocate. So there are some positive signs. Also, the city of Louisville recently passed a resolution to get to 100% renewable energy, and there are now some large solar farms beginning to be developed in Kentucky. That's all I'll say for now.
All right. Thanks, Andy. That was a good rendition. Alan Brandt from Florida, Solar Shepherd, you want to go ahead and talk a little bit about what's happening in Florida?
Sure. I can give you my my view of the Florida situation. First of all, hello to everybody. I am a mechanical engineer, and I have a small business doing solar power system design and consulting, and I do a lot of advocacy work with primarily with Sierra Club, advising some of the local municipalities on energy and particularly solar power issues. But at our state level, as far as utility scale, utility situation goes, we have no renewable portfolio standards in Florida, and I hear no rumblings about us getting any. I don't know any effort being made to get us any. So we don't have RPS. However, we have just started with our largest utility in the state, Florida Power and Light, has just begun what is the largest community solar program in the country. They call it Solar Together, and it's 1,490 megawatt program, 20 47.5 megawatt solar fields to be subscribed, and that they plan to do this, I think, all by the end of next year. And evidently, these fields are getting subscribed about as fast as they're getting put into service. It's a program where you pay a monthly fee for kilowatt hour, and you get in this case, I think it's 3 cents a monthly fee per kilowatt of production capability in the field, and then you get your sliver of compensation for the actual production of these fields, presently at 3 cents per kilowatt hour. And these programs start out cash negative to the subscriber for about the first 5 or 6 years, but after about year 6 or 7, they're supposed to go cash positive for you. They do have a carve out for low moderate income subscribers, and Duke Energy, who's my utility here in this part of Florida, is rolling out a very similar program, half the size of FPL, but about the same parameters. In this case, $7.77 a watt for every kilowatt in the field you subscribe to, and starting out at 3.7506 cents per kilowatt hour compensation, and rising at 1.5% per year. So about the same thing. It looks like it goes cash flow positive for a subscriber in about year 6. We also had The utility here is installing over 500 EV chargers in the last year or so to, this is Duke in this service area here, to see what the habits, charging habits were of people. They were installing level 2 and level 3 chargers free of charge to, we've got 4 of them here in the city, in fact, one at the baseball stadium, one at the art center. Places like that are typical. We recently had a bit of a victory in that about 20 years ago, a bit of legislation was established called the Florida Energy Efficiency and Conservation Act. And it's up for review every 5 years, and it got reviewed last year, and the utilities wanted to end this. It's the sort of program that provides for incentives for more insulation, high-efficiency appliances, that sort of thing. And the utilities wanted to end it, and the Sierra Club, Southern Alliance for Clean Energy, numerous cities. We have my own city. In fact, I was the lead of the campaign at my own city of Dunedin here. We are one of the Sierra Club's Ready for 100 Clean Energy Pledge cities, sort of like Louisville. And we banded together and we wrote letters and had people sign cards at the events. And much to my surprise personally, the Public Service Commission voted against the will of the utilities and decided to maintain this program. So just goes to show that some victories can be had here in Florida. As far as rooftop solar, we have straight net metering. We do not allow third-party energy sales, so there are no purchase power agreements in the state of Florida. If anybody who sells energy to anybody else is considered a public utility, so that makes that bar way too high for anybody to try to leap across. We had, pardon me, in the 2019 legislative session, we had one bit of legislation that was started to lift that public utility designation from the landlord-tenant arrangement. It would have allowed property owners to sell energy to the people who are on that particular property, like a shopping center, mall, that sort of thing, and didn't have any companion legislation in the Florida House, so it didn't go anywhere. We also had a bit of legislation in 2019 to establish community solar programs outside of the utilities, but that didn't have a companion piece in the House either, so it didn't go anywhere. In the 2020 session, we had a long-winded name of the bill, but it was basically called Solar in Schools. In Florida here, there's a per-student limit on the construction costs of a new school, and that precludes the spending on solar. And the legislation was going to make whatever was spent on solar power systems in the construction of a new school exempt from that being figured into that cap. And that bit of legislation made it through 3 committees with only one no vote amongst those 3 committees, made through Appropriations, Education, and Education Innovation committees. However, it never got scheduled for a vote on the actual floor. It had companion pieces in the House and the Senate, but it just wasn't important enough to the House whip, never made it to the floor. So that's my report quickly here from Florida.
All right. Thank you very much. So, Michael, I see that you're online. Michael Walton from Green Spaces Chattanooga. Do you want to go ahead and give us a few minutes here of discussion about what's happening in Tennessee? So everybody knows, this is a new technology I'm using. You have to do a 4-star to unmute your lines because I have everybody on mute to start out with. So go ahead and do that, Michael, 4-star.
Hey, there we go. Sorry, I missed that memo. Can you hear me now?
Yes, you're great.
Okay. Great. So in Tennessee, not unlike Andy in Kentucky, we are exclusively basically served by TVA, which is a federally owned corporation. And so because of that, we really can't have a renewable energy standard at the state level because the state has no jurisdiction over TVA. They're overseen by a 9-member board that is a presidential appointment. With all that being said, there's sort of a good, a bad, and an unknown happening at the state level in terms of energy policy. The good is that TVA has been investing pretty heavily at the utility scale in their renewable energy portfolio. Last year, they accepted proposals for 200 megawatts of renewable energy and ended up contracting, I think, with over 600 megawatts after that RFP because of the prices that they received. So this year they've released another RFP for another 200 megawatts, but we expect that the prices will be just as competitive and they'll probably exceed that in terms of the actual contracts again. The result of that is that for the first 3 months of this year, for the first time in more than 60 years, TVA has gotten more power from renewable sources than from burning coal, which is certainly a big step in the right direction. The bad side from a renewable energy standpoint is that TVA has simultaneously cut all of the programs that existed for small-scale rooftop solar. So while they're sort of very aggressive in supporting utility-scale solar, the opposite is happening on the small-scale solar. And so what has happened is that TVA has basically gotten all of the local power companies that Andy so well described, the municipally owned utilities and co-ops, to sign a very long-term contract with TVA, a 20-year contract that includes some amount of flexibility in their generation, in their ability to self-generate. So that is a new thing. And so that's the sort of unknown part of our energy story, is that all of these local power companies are going to be developing their own solutions for that flexibility if they do anything at all with it. So the larger municipally owned utilities will likely have some sort of programs, probably along the lines of what Alan was describing with community solar. So we have one here called Solar Share, which is I think somewhere around 2 megawatts. That's about half subscribed at this point. Very similar structure is what he described. And so we expect to see probably more of that. But right now, with the lack of a renewable energy standard and the lack of a policy from TVA, there's very little going on in the small scale rooftop. And anything that is happening is all behind the meter. So it's, sized to never generate more than the building is consuming so that they're not selling back to the grid. Because right now, the only thing they can get for selling to the grid is wholesale rates, which is next to nothing. So that's the story in Tennessee right now.
All right. We're going to have Catherine Johnson next, and Tom Stanton joining the call. So after Catherine, I'd like to hear from Tom, if that's all right with Tom.
Hi,
but Catherine,
good afternoon.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Good afternoon. So, hi, I actually am based in Maryland, but I'm a consultant. I've been working on the energy efficiency and renewable space for a long time. And one of the more interesting projects I completed just at the end of the year was attitudes and interest survey for the Department of Energy quality in Montana. And basically, the state of Montana received a DOE Solar Sunshot Initiative grant, and so I fielded a survey designed to test the attitudes and interest among residential customers in Montana about doing either community solar or some type of solar project at a community scale rather than just residential. A couple of the key takeaways were a lot of them were very interested. About 50% of the customers across the board had heard of some type of solar. A few of them had solar, but most of them were willing to, you know, consider it. There was a little bit of a difference of opinion as to whether or not solar would help with climate change and activities amongst the Montana residents. But in general, the ones who were most interested were college-educated homeowners, single-family homeowners, who really wanted to believe that they would even be willing to pay a little bit up more up front because they believed in that solar in the long run would save them money. So it was an interesting study that the Department of Energy Quality in Montana is using, and the next phase will be to see what the steps are now that they've gauged that there is indeed some public interest in community-scale solar. They don't know what it's going to take to do it, but I thought it was an interesting sort of area that hadn't really considered it in the past, and it looks like Montana is also sort of joining the club that says maybe community solar in some way, shape, or form makes sense for our citizens because they certainly have a lot of wide open spaces. So that was pretty much my summary. I you know can get into the survey details another point, another time, but overall it was a really interesting analysis just to sort of see willingness to pay and interest and attitudes. And surprisingly, even people who didn't believe in climate change as occurring were actually supportive of solar, which I thought was an interesting takeaway as well. So you don't have to be on the climate change wagon to understand there might be some economic benefits to solar, which is a good thing to know.
No, I totally agree with you on that. So, all right. Tom, do you want to go ahead and add to this, Tom Stanton?
Yeah, hi, everyone. I'm Tom Stanton. I work with the National Regulatory Research Institute. Our client is all 50 states public utilities commissions, and I study policies about renewable energy, energy efficiency, grid modernization, and topics like that. Let me mention just a few things based on what I heard on the call so far. First, I sent Sierra some information about the National Community Solar Partnership. Right at this moment, Department of Energy is out with a request for proposals and requests for technical assistance from the national laboratories to support community solar activities in any state. There's a national website about this called National Community Solar Partnership, and that leads to an online platform where all the people talking about this have a chance to communicate with one another. I believe that the proposals for technical assistance are due to the department by May 29th. So there's a chance of that any of you who are on the call could either come up with a proposal on your own or work with other people to put together a proposal and send that in. And then depending on what they get, they'll be assigning staff from the different national laboratories to help do the different kinds of assistance that are needed. I'm talking with a large group of participants from all over the country about new models for community solar that work entirely behind the meter, that work with or without a cooperating utility company, so that in those places, many of which have been described on the call, where the utility companies are not yet friendly, we believe that there is a complete business model pathway that leads towards success and the ability to help use community solar to support low-income customers, and that it can be done quite literally without any involvement on the part of the utility company whatsoever and no ability of the utility company to stop it. So if you're interested in that, you can get a hold of me later. My general observation is all over the country, the solar dealers and installers and the policy wonks are all letting the utilities push everybody into different corners where the utilities get to control the whole dialogue, and that's slowing everybody down pretty drastically, and that there are fully economical opportunities already in almost every place in the whole country where the price of solar plus batteries is already completely cost competitive with existing utility rates, such that for any customer that's on a demand charge, certainly, and for any customer that's on a time of use rate, there probably is already a cost effective play where they can get their solar to do some of the things that they want to do with no money down, monthly expenditures cheaper than the energy savings, and pathways forward to gradually taking more and more and more loads one by one away from the utility and serving them through different kinds of solar technology. So that's my spiel for today. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Tom. So I'd like to open it up to conversation among the panelists. I have most lines muted, so again, please do a 4-star to unmute your lines if you have any comments or questions among the people on the panel, Catherine or Matthew. Feel free to talk. Anybody else have anything to comment here? Go ahead and unmute your lines, 4-star. Anything else happening?
Hi, this is Eric Brown. I just wanted to ask Tom if there's sort of research, written up that sort of outlines what you've just said, with numbers from different locations. That would be very helpful if there is.
Well, yes and no. It's something I'm working on gradually in the background, not necessarily part of my day job. There is a massive worldwide effort to bring modern energy technology to the 2 billion people on the planet who started this century without access to anything approaching clean energy. That's the Sustainable Energy for All effort on the part of the United Nations under their sustainability goals. And there are worldwide organizations trying to pursue that by bringing people solar appliances and then what they call solar home systems. Seldom does a solar home system exceed 100 watts. So it's a much more small scale thing than we think of here. It's already a, 20 or so billion dollar per year opportunity, growing at a rate of about 40% per year worldwide. Very extensive networks of companies working on the technologies, quality control, quality assurance provisions for the technologies, and so forth. So there's a huge amount of literature on it coming from other places in the world, including pay-as-you-go mechanisms, which work like what here in the U.S. we have primarily called pay-as-you-save, such that we're seeing that people who used to buy kerosene for 25 cents a week can now change over and buy solar energy in a similar way, so many cents per month, and get access to solar that way. And one of the things we might certainly ask Department of Energy for in this round of funding is technical assistance to do the modeling based on existing utility rates to show how this could work in all these different places around the country.
All right. Comments?
Yeah, Sierra, this is Norman from Annapolis.
Yeah, hi, Norman. Go ahead and introduce yourself, Norman.
Norm Lukafetter. I'm in Annapolis, Maryland. I have a long history in solar. I'd like to have Tom's phone number so I can contact him regarding several of the issues he raised. Tom, I'm Stan. This is Norm Lookerfetter. Could I have your phone number, please?
Thank you. Sierra, do you want me to give it, or are you going to send it out to everybody?
Okay,
I'll go ahead and send it out. That'd be fine. Yeah, sure. And as always, please, everybody's phone number is online at mseforum.com. Go over to Connect and then meet the experts. And all of your phone numbers are listed there. But I'll definitely send it out after the call. In fact, you already have it on the call beforehand. I have the numbers there. But go ahead.
This is Michael Walton in Chattanooga. I would love to see the sort of fully formed business model for the, especially the low to moderate income community solar without the utility. Sounds very much up my alley.
This is Bob Perry. I'm in California, and you would think California would have a robust community solar program, but we are stuck, in neutral here because the utilities programs are just horrible. So yes, I'm very much interested too. So I'll be reaching out to you as well.
Excellent.
Hi, Sierra. This is Vu Nguyen. May I ask a question?
Oh, sure. Go ahead, Vu.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Vu Nguyen. I'm with Tenasca Power Services. I have a question for Mr. Brand from Florida. Is that correct? Mr. Brand, you were speaking about Florida's clean energy initiatives there?
Yes.
Could you provide some clarification around your comment about third-party PPAs, that it's not third-party PPAs, is that for example, behind-the-meter type of renewable energy providers, that is not a permitted option for consumers and businesses in Florida? Is that correct?
That's correct. Because of the way that the Public Service Commission documents are prepared, where it says what qualifies someone to be a public utility, anyone who sells electrical energy to anyone else is considered a public utility. And so then you have to be regulated like a public utility. And so
right.
If Sunrun or someone else should set solar panels on your roof and sell you the energy from it, they have to be considered a public utility. So they just don't try to make that model work here in Florida. Landlord-tenant arrangement I was talking about, there's an ideal place for solar to be utilized. Can't be done, though, presently, because then the landlord becomes a public utility if he sells energy from his solar panels to the tenant in the building.
Yeah, there's a lot of workarounds for that problem, which is a problem in, I don't know, probably 20 states. One of them, which works for residences, is just to have a lease, and you can still have a so that you generate your own electricity from equipment you're leasing, while the ownership for tax purposes is in a third party. I wonder if folks have tried going at it that way.
I was just going to suggest that as well. That's a good point.
Nonprofits, but that's...
The other question I have about third-party PPAs also, I can understand, I think the legislation states, that the law states that you have to, if you're looking to provide it within the state, you have to be designated the public utility. I'm engaged with a lot of other municipalities and organizations in higher education as well, who often look for PPAs that I would call them VPPAs, where they might be purchasing renewable energy outside of their state or their region. Many of the organizations I've worked with For example, they may be in Pennsylvania, but could be buying renewable energy for the attributes as well as the additionality impact also, and doing that in Texas outside of the state. So I wonder if that law there is being interpreted to restrict organizations in higher education, as an example, who would likely be the ones to do something like this, to secure a virtual power purchase agreement, in a neighboring state, as an example, or perhaps even in Kentucky, right, where there's visibility with energy prices there. I would be curious if this law is viewed as restricting that option as well. If anybody has a comment on that, I'd welcome that.
This is Tom Stanton. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Thank you. This whole question is part of the quarterly series of solar policy documents assembled by the Clean Energy Technology Center at the North Carolina State University. They have one series of reports about these PPAs and which states still pretend that it's equivalent to being a utility company and disallow the PPA, and virtual PPAs as well. So that's the source that you would go to see what is happening and what is changing in that realm. Their quarterly publications, and I helped to edit that series.
Great, thank you for that. It's Tom, right?
That's correct.
Tom Stan, thank you.
Anybody else?
This is Andy McDonald. Can you all hear me?
Yes, we're good, Andy.
I wanted to ask people who talked about community solar, what your view is of these very large utility scale community solar projects and whether they really are valuable for the customers. In Kentucky, one of our investor-owned utilities, Kentucky Utilities, LG&E, is building a community solar project, and their financial arrangement for their customers is so disadvantageous to the customer. The customer participating would never see positive cash flow. It's only a money-losing proposition. I was intrigued that Alan said he expects the FPNL and Duke projects to eventually be cash flow positive for customers. And could you comment more on that?
Yes. Am I on? This is Alan. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yep, we're good.
Can you hear me now?
We're good, Alan. We can hear you.
Okay, sorry about that. Okay, yes. In fact, I've been, for the last couple weeks, I've been analyzing Duke Energy's new Clean Energy Connection, the financials of it for a subscriber. They just, about 3 weeks ago, they had their first rollout of it, and they introduced it first to us Sierra Club folks. And then they started introducing it to municipalities, and I got their numbers. And indeed, if what they say is going to happen will happen, then I show that they get cash flow positive in about year five or six. And getting a little bit into technical weeds here, but they're to make that business model, they need to get about a 28% capacity factor out of their solar fields. And I've done some modeling, and if that capacity factor should slip down to 27%, then it takes about 15 years to get cash flow positive in the program. If the capacity factor should be 29%, up 1%, then in fact the subscribers are never cash flow negative. They're actually cash flow positive right from the start. So they've got this program resting right on the edge of the knife financially. I've looked at their 10-year site plan, and they are submitting that to the state that these solar fields, that they are expecting them to have a 29% capacity factor. So maybe they're building a little bit of conservatism into the plan by saying 28% is what they're using for their calculations. But I need to be, in fact, I've got a phone call into the state's renewable energy manager, Duke Energy's renewable energy manager, yesterday to ask him about these issues specifically. But this is a case where the community solar program does indeed give real benefits to the subscriber. It takes a little while, but the benefits are real.
Would you be willing to share your analysis?
Yes. Yes, I would.
Yeah, so go ahead and send anything to me, and I'll forward it to the group.
Alan, are they doing the... I'm sorry, go ahead, Sierra.
No, that's all right. I'll say it. Go ahead, Joe.
Question for Alan Brand. With the siting of the community solar project too, are they looking at opportunity zones for that, or are they considering the equity across the different communities where this project might be located?
I don't know about what they're doing about the siting per se. I do know that they've got a 1.5%, I believe, minimum carve out for the LMI subscribers, which sounds small, but when they consider that, I think they expect about 50 or 60% of their subscribers to be in their biggest subscribers to be commercial, and then after that municipal, and then some small percentage, I think they're expecting about 20% overall to be residential. And so of that 20%, 1.5% of the sum of the whole program will be LMI. That's presently what they have planned anyway.
Appreciate the insights on that. Thank you, Alan.
Any other thoughts here?
This is Tom. I would say there are guidebooks about best practices, and I'll try to generate a quick list of those and get them to you so you can see. If a community solar program is designed so that it doesn't produce benefits starting in month number one, it's not such a great design. It is just, it's like shooting fish in a barrel to create a program that will be fully cost-effective every month, starting with month number one, that can reach out and provide services to low income. None of this stuff is rocket science. It's all been figured out. It's all been demonstrated different places around the country. So to hear that there are still states where the utilities are getting away with these much less than good programs breaks my heart.
Comments?
Amen.
I have one question. I have an 805 number here that I can't identify. Would you tell me who this is? 805-770-8118. Well, okay.
This is Tom. One other thing I can add, the person with 805 probably has to do 4-star to unmute, but because of the COVID-19 crisis, estimates are that the utilities are going to come out of this $2.5 trillion in the hole in the U.S., and there will be a great new emphasis on what are we going to do to help all those low-income customers. We were already operating in many states with around 20% of all the utility customers being unable to afford their bill on any kind of regular basis, let alone what happens when now we find a third of the people unemployed and people not having money coming in and then being allowed to lean on the system for a few months without any threat of shutoff, only to emerge from that moratorium owing unaffordable rent payments or mortgage payments and utility bill payments. So there will be an opening for smart public policy that tries to coach the regulators and the utilities and the customer advocates on what it could mean to try to extricate ourselves from this awful situation.
Any thoughts? Go ahead.
Yeah, this is Bob Perry again. I totally agree. This pandemic opens a lot of opportunities for, you know, totally restructuring how things are done. Here in California, I'm with a policy group. We had two bills on the floor that focused on community energy resilience. The pandemic kind of took the oxygen out of the room, and so we've had to table that. But that's going to become an increasing issue as, you know, these various vulnerabilities make themselves plain. And community solar, first, you know, how community solar has not taken off in California is one of the great mysteries of all time. And it's because the utilities have just made it it doesn't pencil with the rates that they're offering and all the charges and things that they add on to their programs. So we really need to unlock this because there's so much opportunity to install community solar, particularly at schools, I find, because they are sites strategically located within the community to serve an area. And they typically don't have large loads and have lots of space on which to site solar generation and storage. Plus, there's a synergy of being able to fashion curriculum at the schools to where they, you know, students can learn about how to manage these resources. So, you know, there's so much that can be gained if we could just get the utilities to play ball.
I've got another question for the group. This is Andy McDonald. Do folks have thoughts, kind of following up on Tom Stanton's comment about do we have an opening for maybe some really better clean energy policy? Are there organizations that are focusing on this question of what policies can we put out there that could be transformative, that would help low-income people and produce a major employment boost? Energy efficiency and renewable energy investments could really help be transformative to getting the economy going again. Do people know of folks who are focused specifically on that?
Yes, this is Tom. I do, and I'll send a list to Sierra. Got a very good one today from one of the centers working on climate and energy policy out of D.C. And I know the Advanced Energy Economy is working on similar things. Our Michigan Energy Business Innovation Council has just come out with such a statement for our legislature. So, yeah, groups all over the country are doing exactly that.
Great, thank you.
Anybody else? Okay. Well, we have, anybody has any knowledge about community solar, it would be a good time to attend the conference call on Thursday. It's going to be at 3:00 Eastern time, so please note the time zone. And again, this is a work in progress. I think we've got it a little bit more under control than last time as far as the call is concerned. And if you want to talk, it's a 4-star to mute and unmute your lines. It seems to have worked out a little better than it did before. And everybody seems to have gotten in, so progress in that direction. The call on Thursday is going to be talking about Half Moon Bay in California, and they're trying to develop a kind of a community solar type project. You should have gotten emails with some of the graphics on that and comments about what this is about, so you're a little more prepared for the call. I am also working on some of this being online so we can do some presentations that are actually more of a web conference for people who can attend online, but it will still be by phone. So those of you who are driving around and listening instead of looking at your computers, we'll do it that way. Let me know what you think, and hope to see you all next time. Thanks so much for our presenters. And Tom, thanks for coming. I appreciate that. And Catherine and Andy. And Alan, Michael, thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Sierra.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks, everybody.